pleasure to have you listening to my show today, and it's my sincerest desire for you to get something out of this show that will make your life richer, fuller, and in this time of coronavirus pandemic, safer. I'm Reverend Wynn Henderson. As an ordained Christian minister and a retired medical doctor, I have a dual perspective to bring you content to solve problems in your life. Freedom from Addiction and Share Your Mission is the longest-running, single-hosted, and spiritually produced-based radio internet show in the United States. It has been continuously running for the last 20 years plus. Now, I introduce you to celebrities and non-celebrities alike who have something to say about the disease of addiction in its 30-plus different forms and about the importance of finding your mission or purpose in life and then acting on it. If you've been following me for years, you know that I'm very interested in near-death experience for a number of reasons and have probably put on more programs on near-death experience with as many researchers and actual patients themselves than anybody else. And today, no exception, we're going to do a near-death experience show. The book is called The Day I Died, An Unforgettable Story of Life After Death by Steve Shogren. And Steve is a retired pastor, and he has planted churches all over the world, and some with large congregations. And he's got quite a story to tell. And I think what I will do is just say, Steve, it's nice to have you on the program today. And if you want to make any opening remarks, and if not, then tell the audience about your day with dying.
Boy, it's an honor and a pleasure to be with you, Dr. Henderson. That's a loaded, long question.
Well, now, but, you've got to keep this to 2 or 3 minutes. Because we're
I'm with you. but of course, jump in anytime. I can talk about two birds on a stick for a while, you know, even so. A pleasure to be with you again, like I said, and to connect with your audience today. A few years ago, I went in for a simple surgery. I no longer use those words in the same sentence typically, because if they're going to anesthetize you, it's not simple any longer. In my humble opinion as a non-doctor, and it was to supposedly to take out my gallbladder because I was having all the symptoms of a gallbladder issue. We're not able to locate my gallbladder in about 5 different tests that were done in advance. My surgeon said, but everybody has a gallbladder. We can't see yours very clearly. Yours is apparently so impacted, we can't see it. So anyway, as it turns out, not everybody has a gallbladder, and about every 30 to 50,000, from what I've read, is born genetically without a gallbladder. You don't need one, obviously. A lot of people don't have gallbladders, but they went in to take out my gallbladder, which wasn't even there. and to get cut to the point, in the course of the initial few moments of the surgery, nicked my aorta in 2 places. By my belly button. And I mean, it gets worse as the story unravels. And basically for an hour and 15 minutes, I had a blood pressure of 30 over 10, which is extremely, extremely low. 120 over 80 is a ballpark medium range for a normal blood pressure. So in the words of one of my surgeons later on, that I had the blood pressure of a sponge for over an hour, which has had some long-term impact on me otherwise physically, et cetera. But that's the beginning of it, Dr. Henderson. And I that was a number of years ago now, and I've had 8 surgeries to correct the original one, and possibly more, another 1 or 2 to come, possibly. But it's amazing, you know, when you have your body attacked like that, you know, the psychological, the emotional, the physical, of course, that goes on, and it's been quite a story.
There's a lot of different scenarios of what happens to a person when they die. And I'm wondering, what happened in your particular case. Did your soul come out of your body and float on the top of the ceiling and look at you laying down there in bed, or what did happen?
Well, the funny thing is I really, to condense it, I felt as though I was able to see the operation going on from a vertical looking down perspective. I could hear the music in the room. In fact, later I asked a couple of the nurses, actually went to my church. I didn't know them because it was a large church, several thousand on weekends. And at the moment when the accident happened, they realized they had punctured my aorta. One of the nurses said, "You've killed Steve." The doctor didn't even know my name. Said, "Who's Steve?" He goes, "The guy you just killed on the operating table." Well, later I asked him, I said, "In the course of the surgery, were they playing really loud rock music in the room? And was it by chance Led Zeppelin?" And these nurses looked at me and said, "How did you know that?" I said, "I could hear it while I was, out, if you want to call it out or gone." And, oddly, so I was very aware of the room. I could see, I could hear, I felt on, and this is hard to explain how this could be possible physically, but I sensed pressure in my shoulder, even though I was virtually, again, over myself and over the room. And I realized my shoulder was tapping the top of the ceiling. And again, how do you explain that? I don't know. But I became aware at that moment that I was actually looking at myself. I was out. I could see a variety of doctors going full speed ahead, trying to keep me alive. One doctor was Asian, obviously, and had on a face covering. This is the age of after AIDS and bloodborne illnesses galore, of course. So he was working on holding my aorta while the other guys were trying to stitch, and I don't know what all was happening exactly, but later saw him. And I said, he was actually, his daughter went to the same school as my daughter at a parent-teacher night of some sort. I saw him there. "You're the guy that held my aorta together." And he goes, "That's impossible. You were dead for a number of minutes there." I said, "Yeah, but weren't you the guy holding my..." He goes, "Well, that's true, but weird that you would say that, but there's no way you could..." I said it a third time, but I want to talk about this. He just walked away. Obviously was right. I could see specifically him. I could hear the noises in the room, et cetera. So it was definitely a looking down experience, doctor.
So what was the next thing that happened in the course of your life? You were dead. And then what happened next?
Well, I could hear, again, not just the sounds in the room, but I could hear a voice speaking to me, which I now take to be the voice of God. It really came to a personal conversion in college, a faith conversion, crossed over to what I call personal faith. And in that whole time of what I would consider pretty passionately, pretty enthusiastically following Christ in my personal faith, I've never heard the audible voice of God, although many, many, many times I've known God was speaking to me and a still and small voice, as Scripture says. And but at that moment, I could hear the voice of God. And what it was I felt like I was being asked questions, kind of a review of life. They say when you drown that you do a life review very quickly. And this was kind of like a extended life review for me. And it probably happened in terms of chronological time, just a matter of moments, but it felt like it was going on for a long time for me. And the questions I was being asked was, how are you, it was kind of, again, a review. How have you done as a husband, as a dad, as a pastor, as a friend to many? And in each case, it was an encouraging kind of I'm not sure what the right word would be, but a report card, if you will. And it wasn't as though you failed at all, but it was like, hey, you've done okay. You've done well in this other area, but you can always do better. And it wasn't in any way a chiding or a criticism or what have you, a report card. It was more, hey, let's go for it. And I, at that moment, I realized I'm going to make it because there's more to do. There is another step or two in my game that I can add to this thing to become more effective. And but as each time as I was being asked this question, I felt like I was hearing a multitude of voices. It was God's voice, but it was as though there was a I'm not sure the right word, but a whole spectrum of accents and of course, children, adult voices, men's voices, women's voices with accents. And as I was hearing God ask me these questions, I could hear it coming through the filter of lots and lots and lots of people. And you know, it hit me later on that's kind of the way that God, maybe that God speaks is through people. And there's a lot of evidence of Scripture toward the very end of Scripture in Revelation that every tribe, tongue, and nation will be involved in eternity. And so, it kind of makes sense, you know, in the long run that I would hear it that way.
Well, so when did you wake up? You woke up in critical care unit or something sometime later?
Yes. Yes, that night came to, in their version of an ICU, and when you're in a community hospital in the suburbs, it's not much of an ICU unit, but came to, I had no idea what had happened other than this thing is planted in me. I thought it was more like a dream, but of course, you know, how else could it not be than feeling a bit like a dream? And I asked my wife, I had a breathing tube and and I was not able to talk, of course, and had all sorts of gadgetry coming out of me and so forth. And I mushed my wife, give me a pen, and I just wrote down the words, "What is happening?" with a giant question mark. And, well, there's been an accident. And, you know, from there, they put me into a coma, medicated coma. And I was in that state for probably 5 to 7 days, I'm thinking, something like that. And they transported me to the trauma hospital. I woke up. The funny thing is I was in a induced coma, but I was aware of my surroundings, very much so. And that's a whole other angle in the story. I don't know if that was a spiritual awareness or if it was just, you know, the way my body's wired, they can completely, you know, make me unaware of what was going on. But the doctor who had done the work was sitting to the side of my bed, and he was asking me to forgive him. And I said, I didn't say, because I couldn't talk, obviously, but I thought, of course I forgive you. Who in their right mind would do something like that? And I think what he was leading up to is, please don't sue me. And in the end, that again, another part of the whole story there, Dr. Anderson, but incredibly emotional thing from the get-go. About how do you deal with all these issues? I never thought in a million years I'd ever have to deal with as a human. But lots of angles in that whole thing that's shaped me then and now, and I think I'm a better person as a result of the whole thing.
Okay, so before you died,
yes,
did you have a mission that you knew was your destiny in life, and if you did, what was it?
Yeah. Mark Twain said the two most important days of a person's life are the day they are born and the day they figure out why. I like that quote. Yeah. And I was 42. I just had a birthday a few weeks before this happened at age 42. And I remember thinking very clearly, you know, I think I have my groove. I think I know what it is. And it has to do with me carrying an unusual message that the kindness of God leads to, as Romans chapter 2 says, the kindness of God leads to a radical life change, in one translation, a radical life change. And I'd seen that happen in Cincinnati. We had been in a city where nobody was looking for a church, and yet, you know, approximately 1.8 million people would roll their eyes if you said church. They're skeptical and jaded. And so I said, yeah, we're just going to begin to serve people and love them and not worry about the results. And if they come to church, that's fine, but we have zero expectation of talking them into coming to church. We're just going to do practical things to show them the love of God in a practical way. And so began to do, and I, in fact, I'm writing a book right now. I have over 200 things we've tried, believe it or not, that are little practical projects that anybody could do that works especially well with a couple of friends. But going out and serving people, and as you serve them, you know, we're not doing this for money. We would never take your money. We want to show you, if Jesus were here, the same love that he would show you if he was walking around doing practical things for people. And one of my favorite projects is we do car washes for $1, put up signs, people drive by, we say, we will do a fantastic job, and it's $1. Well, we wash their car, get done with it, and then they go to leave. We said, that was worth way more than $1. We go, oh, no, you misunderstand. We're giving you the $1 for the privilege of showing you a little bit of God's love in a practical way. And that's kind of the core of the thing, is how much can we give away and lose and at the same time probably change the world with the practical kindness of God. That's kind of my life message, doing that, writing about it. I've written about a dozen books so far and working on a 13th one right now to give that message away and encourage people.
So where in the course of your recovery did your friend Larry come visit you?
I live now in Claremont, California, on the eastern edge of the LA area. And my friend Larry lives right near here, within 10 minutes of me. So we see each other regularly. And I always thank him for saving my life. But I was in that induced coma state still. And it may sound odd, but I was fully aware of Larry's presence. And later, even though I was in a coma, I was convinced that I was awake and maybe said a word or two to him. But looking back now and talking to him, I was not able to talk at all. But he came in. I've learned a lot more about him coming in that is phenomenal, really. Ended up in the room where he should not have been, where they were not allowing anybody in because it was a totally sterile situation. And he prayed for me, and everything changed. My whole dramatic recovery happened right about that time. Started right then, anyway.
Well, there's evidence that I've gotten personally from people who have written books on this that intercessory prayer at a distance, can heal you. Now, this was prayer close up, but he prayed for you, and immediately you noticed a change?
Yes. The funny thing is I don't know where the emotions or the mental state of a person stops and where their physical starts. I tend to think they go right together. And all I know is that I felt like I was going to make it at that moment when he prayed for me. And I was, you know, as a doctor, Dr. Anderson, you're aware that people can give up and they can, there's a definite connection in the recovery of a person, their willingness to fight and all. And the fight, I felt like it was below zero in me at that point. And for him to show up and pray for me, I think something absolutely physical happened, certainly. At the same time, I think that as important, I got the gumption kind of re-implanted in me. And even though he wasn't supposed to be there, the doctors weren't really up for him being there, and he ended up getting in trouble as he walked out the door. At the same time, I hear more of the story, and it's just a phenomenal, again, I really need to write another book to tell more of the story behind the story.
Thank you. Do need to write another book. Well, you had a 72-year-old friend who was named Carol, who was dying of pneumonia, and you went into her hospital and prayed with her, and you said, "Would you like to hear the good news or the bad news?" What did you tell her?
I said, I really feel like she had been so critical the night before that my good friend had gotten a call and said, you need to get down here. I don't think your mom's going to make it much longer. And that was what got me going. I knew she'd been in the hospital. I didn't realize how critical she was. But I went to pray for her, and I said, you know, I really feel like there's an invitation, put it this way, to live to be 90. And I don't think that, you know, God always makes pronouncements. You will live to be 90. Sometimes he does, I'm sure. But I said, I think he's, I really specifically feel like he's giving an invitation to live to be 90. She goes, I don't want to live to be 90. She laughed a little bit. She did not make it to 90. She has since died. But she got into her 80s, and she developed some kind of a cancer and ended up dying. But, you know, it's funny. I have a feeling that that's a whole different issue. But, you know, maybe we do get invitations on occasion. And if we can turn them down, and maybe that's okay, too. But I felt like there was an invitation there.
Well,
she got out of the hospital that day, by the way.
Sorry? I remember from what you said in your book, you said to her, the bad news is, Carol, you're going to die. But the good news is you won't die for another 20 years. And, well,
that's right.
Okay. So
that's right.
You talked about your accident many times in the book. I don't know how many, but I didn't even count them. You talked about your accident so many times. I'm going to ask you, what if this was no accident, but was your destiny approved by God? And what if God wanted you to stop riding motorcycles?
You know, that's a great observation. Certainly, absolutely, this has been used by God. It shaped my life as my really the life-saving doctor that came along. He was a part of our church too. I'd never met him. But he's the guy that heard my story, volunteered to take the case at this gigantic trauma hospital in Cincinnati. And he said later on, you know, this is going to be the big issue in your life. And you've come to personal faith. That's a huge deal. I like to use the word conversion. And you've had a conversion, if you will, spiritually. But this is going to be, I mean, very close second base of the most important things in life that are most life-changing. And but absolutely, I agree. In a sense, there are, of course, no accidents as God gets involved and he redeems brokenness. He redeems the most unideal, imaginable situations. And certainly he's done that in my life. But I agree with you. He has, you know, the funny thing about the motorcycle comment that you made was the guy who was, again, the Dr. Hanto is his name, H-A-N-T-O, and Doug Hanto is a liver transplant specialist. And so, in other words, people that have a need to, he's done some real innovative stuff with that. He's able to help liver cancer patients live a lot longer by doing some innovative stuff surgically. But he said, you know, in the world of transplants, a lot of people coming in on motorcycle wrecks. He had no idea that I actually had a couple of motorcycles. And I said, oh, yeah. And he goes, yeah, we call them donor cycles. And I thought, oh, this is a double message here. Maybe I shouldn't be riding this donor cycle, you know.
My my experience is that when I was in medical school, the first operation that I can remember attending was of a 14-year-old boy that got hit by a car on his motorcycle. And during the surgery, he died. And I look back at that and know that that was the day that I decided never to ride a motorcycle.
Yes.
What I mean?
Well, yes, I agree.
So
they're very dangerous.
Okay, let's go on. Inspired thoughts. Paul the Apostle said, don't despise people's efforts to get inspired thoughts. In Thessalonians, he said, don't put out the Spirit's fire by treating such inspirations with contempt. Is your book a series of inspired thoughts?
I believe it is. I think when things touch us spiritually, there's an inspired sense in those words. And I'd like to think that absolutely that has been the case. A few years ago, of course, before he passed away, I got to have lunch with Robert Schuller, at the Crystal Cathedral, the famed innovative, started a lot of things in motion that have changed the spiritual state of America. But I got to have lunch with him, and he goes, "You know, Steve, one of the most important prayers I've ever prayed, and I pray it all the time when I get stuck, is God, give me an idea." And I thought, what an incredibly simple yet profound prayer to pray. And I prayed that prayer, you know, and this is, of course, the lunch I had with him was long before I wrote that book. But God, give me an inspired idea. I want to not have just Steve ideas. I want to have your ideas. And I'd like to think that he gave me a few there, and I'd like to live a life such, you know, after the fact that I can actually pick up on his ideas. And I it's the most exciting thing in the world, Dr. Henderson, is to have a sense of the presence of God inspiring things, not just ideas, but as I talked about earlier, going out and serving people, showing them the love of Christ in a practical way, and sensing his pleasure in doing that, and his love being there as you're doing that. It's an amazing thing.
Well, you probably don't know my backstory, but the first book that I wrote, The Cure of Addiction, was mm-hmm. the result of God making me the offer during a dream of writing the book, and he was going to dictate to me the basics, and if I wanted to do that, he promised me three things. Now, I don't have time to get into what he promised, but let's say the chance of those three things happening was less than winning the lottery twice, and so I said, "Okay, God, I'm your servant. I'm going to do what you want to do." And it took 2 years, but I wrote the book, and it was called The Cure of Addiction, and it was God's plan on how to overcome various different types of addictive behaviors in your life. And I call that direct inspiration from God. And so that's where I come from, knowing that it can happen because it happened to me and it happens to other people. I didn't hear the words, but I just felt the words, if you know what I'm saying. Okay, so that's what I wanted to talk about, inspired thoughts. Another thing is what you learn from this about the fear of death. A city leader's mother who was dying with metastatic carcinoma, I was referred to you to have a prayer with her in her hospital, as I remember. And you did that. And you said, if you have a childlike relationship with God, you have nothing to fear in death. Death is not the big, scary, overwhelming enemy that our culture has made it out to be. Until we get past the fear of death, we will be prevented from taking a risk in life. You don't have to fear death. It's really that simple. There's a better way to live. And I think if you don't fear death, then you can more fully live. I think
that's right.
You would agree with me there.
Absolutely. Yep. And in fact, I'm writing a book about that too. I it sounds like all I do is write three books at a time, but I actually have a book thick with notes already of overcoming the fear of death, the concern for death, what have you. And there's a saying that in studies, people consistently say their greatest fear is speaking in front of people, and down the list, 2, 3, or 4, whatever, is the fear of death. And I don't believe that for a minute. I think that the number one fear, the number one concern, if you want to call it that, is dying. And what do you do? How do you face that reality? And, I think it was Jerry Seinfeld said that he agreed with me. He said, in other words, some people are saying, I would rather be the guy in the coffin than the guy giving the obituary in front of the coffin. He goes, there's no way that's true. And so I think that there is absolutely nothing to fear in death. And it sounds cliche, but I can almost say been there, done that. And it wasn't a process. It was kind of thrown on me, as my story goes. But the idea that that we could really come in face-to-face and survive, and it's not as crazy as you might think.
In my most recent book on addiction, I write about the fear of death and give advice. And if you want to follow my podcast, it's www.freedomfromaddiction.libsyn.com. Mm-hmm. Spell Libsyn, L-I-B as in boy, S-Y-N, no spaces, no capitalization. And you can search back over 200 different episodes on everything in the world that you wanted to know or didn't want to know, but you had to listen to it. And I would suggest that you do that.
Yes.
Because if you're fearing death, you're not fully living. And in this not fully living, you're suffering. You're suffering with anxiety, depression, all sorts of things. So the best thing that you can do for yourself is figure out how to not fear death. And some of us said the top two things in fears in the country are the fear of death and the fear of public speaking. And now I don't fear either one of them. So that's good. Okay, so I wanted to ask you about addictions. I define addictions as if you have a behavior, any behavior, that you find is hurting you or hurting someone you love and you can't stop it, then you're addicted to it. Now, using that definition, were you addicted to work?
Yes. The way you described it there, yes. I was addicted to activity connected with work. I was addicted to thinking approximately 25 hours a day about how to more effectively do what we're doing as a church. And of course, it grew. I was, my role was I was kind of the stand-in evangelist. And I, of course, I wasn't like Billy Graham by any means, but I was thinking like him. And of course, part of that was why the church grew, is it wasn't a maintenance thing at all. But and the really gigantic downside, of course, is that you can't turn it off. And so I don't relish, and I don't feel like I was living in a great place of balance at all at that point.
So I don't know. I haven't asked you, but I would assume that your workaholism is either slow down considerably or quit. Are you in a better than there now?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And it's 20 years gone by now, and I don't have the energy I did have, for one thing. But, you know, a lot of what was going on with me was I was, again, my mind was engaged. And that, to not have your mind engaged is not a good thing, obviously, but to not be able to turn it off. And I've learned certainly to turn the intensity knob down, numbers of notches. Before the accident, I took the DISC test, the personality inventory that's used by a lot of different groups. And it showed that I was what they call a driver, was almost off the scale prior to the accident. And then that's the D, that they use the letters D-I-S-C. D is the driver. The I is the inspirational. And how inspirational are you versus the driver part? And my I was clearly there, but it was down quite a bit from the D. And I think it's a great thing is that my D has lowered. I'm less of a driver, and my inspirational level as a leader, as a friend, as a human is near the top now. And I think that's progress.
Well, they say that every bad experience can be a good experience if you use it to make a change. And you
absolutely
had that experience. You got killed.
Yeah.
But if it moved you from being something that was not really good for you to a better position, then it was positive.
Right.
That's the way I look at
it. Yes. I agree.
Now,
did God cause that? I don't think so, but I think he's certainly using it. I mean, he has used it dramatically, not just in my life, but through my life, too.
Well, you know, when you say, did God cause that, people say, did God cause that storm, or did God cause that fire, or whatever like that? And we don't want to think that God was out there starting these kind of bad things that happen to people, but he certainly allows them, and when he allows them, he is there to pick up the pieces and to improve your life. So that's the way I look at it. Now,
absolutely, I agree.
I wanted to talk about, during this course of your recovery, you suffered from depression, and I can understand that.
Right.
When I was practicing family practice, I would have 10, 15 people a day that would come in and want some Prozac, because they were depressed. And I would tell them, you're not depressed because you're low on Prozac. Here's what I want you to do. Take this prescription. I want you to go out every day and do something to help somebody that's in worse shape than you are. And don't get money for it. Don't try to get any praise for it. Just do it. And come back in 30 days and we'll have another talk. And, you know, practically everybody that did that wasn't depressed anymore. And I think that that is something that can be a good teaching lesson.
I agree.
Every
I certainly agree.
The spiritual basis to it, because that's the way that God set it up. But I just wanted to make a comment and see if, if you agreed with that.
No, I agree. Scott Peck... I imagine you're familiar with Scott Peck. He's since passed away, but he was a psychiatrist in New York City and was walking down the street one day, and he said, similar to what you said, actually, he said, God decided he wanted to write a book. And he wrote it through Scott Peck, called The Road Less Traveled, which became very popular in its day. Still probably doing okay. But he said that in the course of, as a psychiatrist, he had people come to him who were stuck. And his... and he didn't do the same thing every time, but I would bet there's a few Prozac stories mixed in there, like yours, Dr. Henderson. But he said that he would write on a script, get converted, and then he would just rip off the sheet and hand it to them like it was a medication. And then they'd look at him and say, what do you mean by that? And he goes, that's for you to discover. You know, part of conversion is discovering how to find faith. And he says, of course, it has to do with other people. And very similar to what you just said. And he said very often people come back a month or two, or sometimes a year later, and they'd say, I got it. And when we convert our spiritual brokenness, I completely agree. Some people probably need to do that and the Prozac for a time, you know.
I met Scott Peck at a lecture that he gave in Knoxville, Tennessee, and later had him in my program. He was one earlier celebrities, but really nice guy, and as you said, passed now.
Wow.
Finally.
What a gift he's been.
Yeah. Finally, I drove 16 hours from Tennessee to Central Florida to get an interview with Terry Schiavo's father. The story made that much of an impression on me. And basically, I'll just say that back, I think it was around 95, I'm not sure, but at any rate, it was a story that everybody in the country was thinking about one way or the other. And so Terry had a stroke, and she had what I call locked-in syndrome, and parents thought that she could hear them, and her husband didn't want her to continue to live for a number of reasons, and went to court, and the court allowed him to let her die. And so you can, of course, get more of that story from me, but why did you put Terry Schiavo's case in your book at the end of it?
Well, you know, one comment before I say much more on that is that the book came out in Swedish, and it's been translated into a couple, three different languages. But it's Swedish. I speak Norwegian. It's just a funny sounding title, "Dagen jag dö." Doesn't that sound like those? You know, the message is the sound of it too. The day I died, and they took that chapter, that last chapter about Terry Schiavo, out of the book. They said, you know, we're not ready to process this in Sweden. And so, you know, it's funny. Even though it was a huge issue in America, other parts of the world, they've resolved it as we're not even going to get involved in that conversation. I think that the implication is they would side with the husband and letting her die. But I found that a little bit disturbing and concerning, but they did it that way, and I thought that was their decision. But the reason I put it in the book was because I think it really captures fairly succinctly the whole issue of who's in charge of my medical care. And I have quite a bit in the book, The Day I Died, about that. And I say you need to be the guy, you need to be the husband, the wife, the father, the whatever, the daughter of the person who's being treated. And either they themselves, if they're able to make the decision, or you need to decide what is best for you versus necessarily lockstep going with the experts. And you know, in the end, 99% of what the experts wanted to do for me was fantastic and was an obvious yes. But the 1% at the first hospital was at a point where if my wife had not had the gumption to say, this is not going to, this will not abide, as Big Lebowski calls it, this will not abide. I'm not going to let this happen. I was moved to a larger hospital, saved my life, clearly. And so there's got to be capacity in us to not let it abide just because the quote-unquote experts say it. And you know, that, and hopefully they'd be honest enough to say, this is my opinion, not the gospel truth. That and I may be, that's why I'm practicing medicine. Hopefully most doctors would agree with that, you know.
Well, in Terry's case, in my opinion, she was inside herself and she could hear what was going on and being said and everything, but she couldn't communicate. There's another famous story of a book that was written called The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. And in this book, it was the editor-in-chief of the French magazine L.A., who suffered a stroke and lapsed into a coma, and he woke 20 days later, mentally aware of his surroundings, but physically paralyzed with what is known as locked-in syndrome, with the only exception of some movement in his head and eyes. And his right eye had been sewn shut because of irrigation in the eye problem. Now, the entire book was written by Bobley, that's his last name, is Jean-Dominic Bobley, by blinking his left eyelid for his administrative assistant. And over a period of 10 months, 4 hours a day, he used this method to write the book, The Diving Bell.
Oh, my.
But he had to blink his eyes so many times to come up with a letter, and then she would write down that letter, and then they would go on. The book took about 200,000 blinks to write, and the word took approximately 2 minutes. And the book also chronicles everyday events for a person with locked-in syndrome. And so Terry was not the only person in the world that has had this problem. And so I just plead for more compassion on somebody that can't respond to you but knows how you're treating them and what you're doing with them. And
yes.
So
I was fully, again, I, it wasn't locked in syndrome, I guess, in my case, but I was aware when they thought I wasn't aware. And it was clear, I could hear them making comments about my situation. And later on confirmed it with the care staff, with Janie, my wife, who was there. And so absolutely, yeah. They say, you know, talk to a patient in a coma as though they can hear you. If I'm a test case, absolutely, that's the right thing to do. In fact, there was kind of an irritating thing that happened as well. They kept playing the same Christmas CD on repeat. I mean, dozens and dozens of times. They liked to hear it. Well, I was the one listening to it in a coma. They assumed that I wasn't able to hear anything. But I still enjoy Harry Connick Jr., but not that album.
Well, some surgeons have stories where their patient who is anesthetized and not be able to hear anything comes back after they wake up telling them what they said. So I know it happens, and you need to be careful what you're saying to somebody that apparently can't hear you, because quite often they can.
Yes.
Steve, it's been great to have you on the program explaining what happened to you, and I didn't get into all the things that you learned from this experience, but it's in the book. The book is The Day I Died by Steve Sjogren. And you spell that S-J-O-G-R-I-N. Or is it
G-R-E-N? I'm sorry.
And I imagine you can find that on Amazon and wherever books are sold?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yes.
And do you want to give the listening audience any contact information, like a website or anything?
Yeah, I would say go to my personal website. It's my name, Steve Sjogren, and it's actually sjogren.com, stevesjogren.com. And you can pick up on what we're doing right now as a ministry, what we're our focus, and my writing and so forth. But in fact, right now we're on a tour, which has been on hiatus for a bit because of COVID, as we're recording this anyway. And we have a couple of these, one in the Midwest and one here in Los Angeles, of a inflatable toilet that's 19 feet tall that says, "Make kindness great. Make kindness great." We've been in an odd time where there's such a division in America. And we want to go around and serve our way into major metropolitan areas. And so we're doing that. And we have a character called Captain Kindness, who dresses up like a superhero and has a gigantic toilet brush. And then we scatter with our teams around in the community and wash public toilets to show a little bit of God's love in a practical way. And you wouldn't believe the conversations we get into. They are fantastic. So we're doing that. Soon to go to Phoenix, and soon to go to the West Coast as well.
Well, it sounds like you have a great ministry, Steve, and just want to honor you and what you're doing and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I want to play this podcast on my website, so hopefully I can get a copy of this sent to me.
Okay.
It'll be available there too. Okay.
Well,